After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Dale Borglum's Healing at the Edge. We are very happy to share with you Dale's profound insight and open heart. Please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Dale to support this podcast.
Welcome to the Ram Dass Fellowship live stream event with Ram Dev. So glad you're here. I'm Jackie Dobrinska. I'm the Education and Community Outreach Director for the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. And I'm just really excited to be with you all tonight as we find ways to connect through the community. And community is so important, especially during these times. Meister Eckhart has said that community is where our great gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Or in other words, this is how we feed each other, is by coming together. And the Ram Dass Fellowship is where we deepen these connections within the community. And we've been doing that by creating these virtual events and by supporting people in connecting to each other through local satsangs. It's sort of how we take the energy of the in-person events and keep it going. If you're not a member of the fellowship, make sure you sign up by going to ramdass.org and you can search for fellowship. And there's a sign up through that. This call started for just the fellowship, but due to these times, we've increased it and invited the whole community to be a part. And so tonight, it's available on ramdass.org, on Facebook, and on the YouTube channel as well. And throughout the evening, you can access the chat in any of those to ask questions. We'll have a Q&A session at the end. So this format provides such an opportunity for this worldwide connection. And so we come together in this space. And if we were in person, just by coming together, we create sort of this sacred ritual space. And when you're on these sort of virtual formats, it's really easy to get distracted or a little disembodied. And so before we begin, I'm going to invite you to sort of settle into your space. If you have a candle nearby, maybe you light the candle. Or just tune into the hundreds of people that are in this time together on this call. Or just feel your feet on the ground and take a couple of nice, big, deep breaths and feel it in your body. And feel it in your heart. And so tune into that loving awareness that you are. And now we enter into our satsang space together. And tonight we're presenting the tools for spiritual healing in a time of uncertainty. And it's with Ram Dev. And Ram Dev, also known as Dale Borglum, founded and directed the Hanuman Foundation Dying Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which was the first residential facility in the United States to support conscious dying. He's been the executive director of the Living Dying Project in Santa Fe, and since 1986 in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's also the co-author with Ram Dass, Daniel Goleman, and Dwarka Bonner of Journey of Awakening, a Meditator's Guidebook, Bantam Books, and has taught meditation since 1974. Dale lectures and gives workshops on the topic of meditation, healing, spiritual support for those with life-threatening illnesses, and on caregiving as a spiritual practice. And so with that, I will turn it over to Ram Dass.
Thank you so much, Jackie. It's really a pleasure to be here. And certainly this time we're living in, this pandemic, is uncovering so many opportunities for practice. In Buddhist practice, before one begins to practice, there are contemplations that are done to deepen our level of practice. And the first contemplation is, you're going to die, but you don't know when. There could be nothing more intellectually obvious than that. But we, at the same time, push that to the back of our consciousness. If, in fact, during this webinar, we did not know that we were going to be alive at the end of this hour and a half or this hour and a quarter, however long we're going to be together, if we really didn't know we were going to be here then, how would it affect the way we were willing to open to each other, to love each other, to be in this community in a very full way? So I can give a spiritual pep talk, but that really is a contemplation. How much can we allow this certainty of death, but the uncertainty of its time, to penetrate into us so that we are much more willing to do the radical surrender, dying into love? I have been working with dying people, as Jackie suggested, since back in the 1970s with Stephen Levine and Ram Dass. We started the Dying Project. Then I changed the name to the Living Dying Project because I got tired of having to explain to people that they didn't really need to promise to die to work with us, or beyond that, that the project itself was not dying, the Dying Project. But be that as it may, for all these years, I've been blessed to be with people who are approaching the end of their lives. One of my first meditation teachers, Trungpa Rinpoche, said that until you come into intimate contact with death, your spiritual practice will have the quality of you being a dilettante. So here we are during the pandemic. I think for many people, almost everybody I talk to, there is a level of anxiety that's arisen that was not so apparent before the lockdown, before the pandemic. And one of the things I've really been exploring with people is it necessary that uncertainty leads to anxiety? Uncertainty leads to stress. There's the uncertainty of when we're going to die. There's the uncertainty of, are we going to like this webinar? There's the uncertainty of, is the virus coming in through the mail slot, or is it coming in through your neighbor or your friend? But is it possible to use uncertainty not as something that's a problem or something that we're getting tight in relationship to, but it's bringing juice to our life? It's bringing excitement in a certain way. Without, of course, denying that there are millions of people who are really at risk now. People are financially at risk, medically at risk, socially at risk in all kinds of different ways. So Walt Whitman had this great quote. He said, "Sometimes touching another human being is almost more than I can bear. Almost more than I can bear." We've, most of us experience that, but how often do we experience it? How often do we fall back into one moment after the other in a sort of a slightly disassociated way with our lives? So is it possible to use the pandemic, the uncertainty that we're now living with, as an inspiration for deeper practice, to plunge more deeply into our heart, to plunge more deeply into practice? And in my work with dying people, I have developed the healing paradigm that I found really useful, both personally and for the people that I'm working with. And It's rather straightforward. The first step of healing is, can we be mindful of what it is that's going on? Can we be with our moment-to-moment experience? For many Westerners, however, cultivating mindfulness in a way that we can integrate into our daily life is a really difficult thing. Many people are pretty good meditators. They have a lot of devotion, but then there's work, then there's the relationship, then there's the traffic jam, and it gets much more difficult to actually be integrating practice into this daily activity. The Dalai Lama, on his third visit to America, said, "Now I'm beginning to understand, and it makes me very sad. You Americans don't like yourselves." And the reason that he was saying this, pardon me as I put this back in, the reason he was saying this is because most of these Eastern practices from Hinduism and Buddhism were developed a few thousand years ago for people who were grounded and centered, who loved their mommy and daddy, who didn't have an iPhone or didn't have an automobile. It was assumed before you began this big project of disidentifying with character structure, with ego structure, and identifying with true nature, that you were grounded and centered, that you were inhabiting your bottom chakras, the first, second, and third chakras. And then you could begin this big project of dissolving into the spaciousness of the heart, the boundless heart, the heart of compassion, the heart of loving kindness. Ram Dass, for the whole first part of his life, he talked about be here now, just being present. But as his life continued, he began to transition into his main teaching was be here now with loving awareness, not just awareness, but loving awareness. It's hard to find the courage to stay in the heart when the environment is challenging if we have not done some of this foundation work. So for my own self, I'm a recovering mathematician. Believe it or not, I have a PhD in mathematics. I don't know if you can imagine what that did to my mind. I went right from Stanford to Maharaji. It was like very discontinuous. I needed to come back to America and really work with getting into my body. So that I've been finding for a lot of people that's incredibly useful at the beginning of the healing path or the beginning of a meditation practice to spend some time getting embodied. As we began today, Jackie said, feel your feet. And I think that's really a great way to start practice. But even beyond that, to begin to do some grounding breaths, some centering breaths, as you breathe out, drop down into the base of your torso. As you breathe out, drop down into the lower belly, the hara, the place from which martial arts are done. And I would even suggest, as we're doing this webinar, it's not so much about collecting information that's going to be useful, but can we be living this together? Can we be, as I'm talking about being grounded, what does it feel like to trust that the Mother Earth, that which grounds the earth element, Mother, that is creating and generating support and nourishment that is always there, that we can tune into. And in fact, this whole pandemic where so many people are having to stay home, it's almost like the mother said, you've been bad boys and girls, and you're going to have to take a time out now. And I want you to go into your room and really think about what you've been doing, how you haven't been taking care of the planet, how you haven't been grounded and really feeling that sense of support. And when you're ready, then you can come out and play again. So many people have meditated for a long time. When they came to some of my groups and I really encouraged them to start dropping down into the base, feeling the root chakra, and then the second and third chakra, feeling the power, the sense of being centered, it really changed their practice. And it might be, I don't know how much time we'll have, how much talking, how much meditating and Q&A, but it might be we could do a short guided meditation that we bring in these notions of dropping down into the belly, dropping down into the down into being grounded. So being grounded is what we learn the first couple years of life. Little baby, 0 to 2 years old, learning to trust that she is being supported. And that's the immediate antidote to fear. When we feel ungrounded, like many people do during the pandemic, the immediate antidote is to drop down and feel that sense of support, that it's safe to be dependent, that the mother is protecting us. Maharaji said, you cannot realize God until you understand the mother. And understanding the mother might be, of course, the work of a lifetime, but at least one part of it is the sense of trusting the nourishment that's always there, trusting that the guru, that the mother, is always supportive. Okay. And then from the ages of like 18 months to 4 or 5, it's about dropping down into the belly, moving from dependence to independence, learning that now one can go into the world and manifest, that there's a sense of being centered, that here I am and I'm doing what it is that the universe is calling forth from me. And that's the antidote to feelings of guilt and shame. Then at the age of 5 or so, children start learning about conscious relationships, loving awareness, not just awareness. Can I actually have conscious relationship? And basically what we're doing here is we're implying that there can be a healing path. So the first step in healing is, can I be present enough to be with what it is that's going on? Can I be grounded and centered? Can I be mindful? So that the embodied sense of mindfulness is this grounding and centering. And then so ages 0 to 5, we're learning to be embodied, to be present for what it is that's going on. And then from ages 5 to 8, we're learning about going into the heart. And this then suggests that if a difficult emotion arises, fear, anxiety, grief, the first thing is, can we be with it? What does it feel like to have this experience? Usually when fear arises, we get very busy being triggered and focused on the trigger. It's not that I'm just feeling fear, but I'm afraid of getting sick. I'm afraid of going broke. I'm afraid that my relationship might not work out. I'm afraid that my meditation practice is not bearing fruit in the way that I had hoped that it might be able to do that. Right? So we become aware of, what does it feel like to be afraid? What does it feel like to have anxiety? Is it possible to feel uncertainty and not even move into anxiety? Is it possible to be with the uncertainty of this world now and just be with the feelings and then begin to have compassion for the part of me that's having those feelings? Self-compassion, self-love is really, in my humble experience, the central focus, the turning point in spiritual practice. That we can't really love other people, we can't really have compassion for other people until we have been able to work with some of these places deeply within our own psyches. So a difficult emotion arises, can I have compassion for that part of myself? If I'm not feeling independent, autonomous, and this being who's down there in my belly, it's going to be really hard to do that. And it's going to be really hard to be centered if I'm not trusting groundedness. So there are these developmental stages that eventually will allow us to be able to keep our heart open, even if the environment is not being supportive. The Dalai Lama said, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. So just imagine how simple your life would be if the motivation for your actions were compassion, not do they like me? Am I getting enough? What's going on here? But what is the compassionate thing to do? What is it that will bring more compassion into the world? So initially, we're practicing to get grounded and centered so that we can be present. But then the motivation begins to be, how can I serve? And this Love, Serve, Remember Foundation is, of course, based on love for Hanuman, using the notion of selfless service as the way we're expressing devotion. There's the story of the Ramayana, the story of Rama and Sita and Hanuman. And Ram and Sita get separated. Sita gets kidnapped by the demon Ravana. And the male part of God and the female part of God can't find each other until Hanuman, devotion through selfless service, helps them come back together. So that the selfless service, maybe during the pandemic, maybe it doesn't mean you're going out and actively doing things. Maybe it's sitting in your room and doing compassion practice for all people who are suffering. I've been working with a lot of groups, and all of my face-to-face groups have turned into Zoom groups. And people are often being overwhelmed by how much suffering is going on in the world now. If, in fact, they start doing practice for all beings, feel some connection with all beings, then in a very real way, as the heart gets bigger, the heart is large enough that it contain all that suffering, and all that suffering is still there, but it's contained in a much, much larger container, if you will. Just as an example, there was some studies done a number of years ago using psychedelics as a psychotherapeutic agent to help people who had fear of death. And people in the study had, quote, terminal cancer, unquote. They had three guided sessions. After the three sessions, they did the study, and people had a lot less fear of death. But what they found that really surprised them was that many of these people, when they entered the study, had a great deal of physical pain because they had terminal cancer. But that the psychedelic sessions had statistically, in a highly statistically significant way, reduced the need for pain medication, even though psychedelics have no pain-relieving properties. But if I think that I'm 5 feet, 8 inches tall and weigh 170 pounds, then X amount of pain bouncing around inside of me can be a real big problem. But if I, on the other hand, have this experience that leads me to believe I'm the whole universe, then that pain isn't such a big problem anymore. So doing practice for all beings, rather than I'm practicing here so I can get enlightened, for me really deepens my practice. It really is a deeper sense of motivation that brings me back to practice again and again and again. When I talk to people, I've got a guy in one of my groups who lives in the Bronx, and he hasn't gone out the front door for 6 weeks. He's been in his apartment in the Bronx for 6 weeks. He says, it's totally silent there. You can't hear anything. It's like a deserted city, except ambulances back and forth all day and all night, ambulances taking people to the hospital. And he's, when you hear the ambulance, does that close your heart, or can that be the signal to open your heart to the person in the ambulance, where the ambulance is going? Okay, so I see that there are some questions coming, and part of what I was hoping to do here is, instead of me doing just a really long talk, if there are some questions coming up, maybe Jackie could find the good ones and let me know what they are, and we'll take some breaks in the lecturing thing here and begin to have some more interactive part of it. So what I'm finding is that these somatic practices help create a foundation that allows our heart to be open. Something from JR here that I'm not quite understanding how to deal with. Okay, I see. Okay.
So I'll read them to you. Okay. Yeah. So one of the questions that's coming up is technology interfering with our chi?
That's a great question. Is technology interfering with our chi? So as I was saying before, there are these developmental stages. 0 to 2, you learn to be grounded. 2 to 5, you learn to be centered. 5 to 8, this opening the heart thing is about having appropriate boundaries. And I remember when we were with Maharaji, he would eat poison. Somebody gave him some arsenic, and he took a whole mouthful of it. Nothing happened to him at all. So that if you identify as I'm really sensitive that having my router on close to my bed, or that I'm on Zoom all day long, I'm looking at a screen all day long. If you identify with, I'm somebody who's going to be bothered by that, it's probably going to bother you. I just read this like amazing article in the New York Times 2 days ago. And what they came up with was that they studied three groups of people, 30,000 people they studied. The first group had high stress, and they felt that being stressed was not good for them. And they were 43% more likely to die than the people who didn't feel that way. The second group had high stress, but they thought, this is okay, I can work with this. And the third group had low stress, but the second group that had high stress were healthier than the ones with low stress because they were using the energy. Okay, so basically, we've talked about awareness practice, mindfulness practice, then the second stage is heart practice. But the third stage is Tantra, seeing difficulty as an opportunity. So is it possible that there's this opportunity with the pandemic? There's this opportunity with all this information that's coming in through your screen that increases your chi. It's really a lot about how much are you loving the mother. The mother isn't just the lack of electronics. The mother is everything. The beloved can only be everything. Thomas Merton had this great quote, love and prayer are learned in the hour when prayer becomes impossible and the heart turns to stone. So that in some ways, being on Zoom all day is a little bit difficult. It's not as nice as being outside in nature, being with your friends. But at the same time, can we work with the ways that that begins to close our heart? There's more energy. I'm communicating with people all around the planet now, almost every day. And to the extent that I'm feeling connected, that's chi that I can work with. That's chi that feeds me. That's chi that can be shared. So that there is no shortage of chi or prana or shakti in the world. It is our sense that I'm separate from Maharaji, I'm separate from God, I have to protect myself, I'm this limited being. So that, yes, we are limited. We have a body. One day the body's going to get sick and die. Maharaji died of a heart attack. Ramana Maharshi died of cancer. Ramakrishna died of cancer. You got a body, you're going to die. It's going to happen. But at the same time, I remember one time we were with Maharaji and Ramdas was having a bad day. And he came up to Maharaji and said, I'm really having a bad day. I feel so impure. I'm so angry at a few people. And Ramdas had on long sleeves, and Maharaji looked up the sleeve of his shirt and said, I don't see any impurity. So can we see the sacred in everything? Once the heart opens enough through devotional practice, through mantra, through prayer, through tonglen, through cultivating compassion, when the heart becomes spacious enough, when the heart becomes connected enough, that then leads to the stage of Tantra, where we begin to see it all as sacred, even the dark mother. So God is just not the nice part. God is also the difficult part. God is COVID. God is cancer. God is war. God is Donald Trump. God is, one of the lines I have now in my groups, it just drives people crazy, is when you are dying, Donald Trump will be at your bedside. Okay. Now, for the people who hate him, that drives them crazy. And for people who love him, that drives them crazy too. It's not that he's going to be there physically, of course, but any place where you are caught up in that image of him leading you into unconscious reactivity, that's still going to be part of your life as you're dying. And in some very fundamental way, spiritual practice, life itself, is preparation for dying. Not in a morbid sense, but even learning to die into the moment, learning to die into this next moment. Can we die with love into this next moment with loving awareness? And to the extent we can do that, then electronics, no electronics, it's all good. But at the same time, we have to be aware enough that there are places where you and I are caught, that if you're on Zoom all day, your brain gets fried and you've got to take a break. So it's both at the same time, that certainly there is the case that it's all perfect and it's all God. Suzuki Roshi said, we're all perfect, but there's still room for improvement. And the place where there's still room for improvement is the place where we're still getting caught. So it's both at the same time. Any other great questions there?
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's such a good reminder on all these pieces. So there's another question here from, it looks like, Louis on YouTube. You talked about the stages of development. Is that an analogy for spiritual development stages?
So, the stuff I'm teaching is nothing new. But what I think I found that I haven't heard anybody else say, that there is a remarkably consistent parallel between Piaget's stages of early childhood development, the unfolding of the Buddhist's system of Jhanas, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Dzogchen, the awakening of the chakras, other stages of somatic theory. They're already saying that there are these developmental stages, that you can't really rest in your heart until you've learned to be centered and present and be able to be who you are. And it's hard to be who you are in the martial art of being you until you've trusted this dependence that the mother is taking care of you. So that maybe this is a great spot to plug myself, that if you go to the Living Dying Project website, livingdying.org, there's a lot of free talks that go into this stuff much more deeply than we're going to have a chance to today. Video, audio, text files. I also have a podcast channel on the Be Here Now Network, along with Ram Dass and Krishna Dass and Raghu and the whole cast of characters, Jack and Joseph and Jackie and everybody. So, and Sharon, all that stuff is there. There's also an online workshop that goes into this much more deeply that could prepare you for deeper practice or for working with people who might be approaching the end of their life.
Great. So Devin asks, I've come to find that surrendering to deep loss and deep love often leave me to the same place of tears, connection, and overwhelm. Yeah. How do we practice holding space for it all, even in overwhelm?
So that's a great question. That's a really great question. Grief are the emotions that arise to feeling separate. It's not just being sad because somebody died or because somebody left, but somebody cuts you off in traffic and you get angry. That's a grief reaction because you're not feeling connected to that person. We're feeling separate. Compassion, on the other hand, the compassionate heart has some really important defining qualities. The compassionate heart is connected, connected to self, connected to each other, connected to God. The compassionate heart is spacious, and the compassionate heart is warm. So Rumi has this wonderful quote. He says, grief is the garden of compassion. When we're feeling grief, can we transmute the feelings of grief and separation into feelings of compassion and connectedness? It's an ongoing process. Everybody in this room is grieving. Even if you're not paying attention to the pandemic, even if you haven't anybody close to you die lately, we're all grieving because we have lost parts of our childhood. We have lost parts of our identity. You probably lost some pets along the way, or there's all this loss. So that, can we use that loss to show us where we're caught in separateness and do conscious grief work? So that occasionally you go into a protected sacred place, your bedroom in front of your altar out in nature, and you invite the grief to come. And instead of saying, I'm grieving because of the pandemic, I'm grieving because somebody died, I'm overwhelmed by this grief, what does it feel like to have these feelings? Going back to that healing paradigm that I was talking about, the first step is feeling what's going on, clear, mindful, embodied awareness. What is it like to be in my body right now feeling grief? And then the next step is, can I then open to what that feels like with an open heart? Now there's two things to do, not just be aware, but be aware with compassion. And in fact, psychologists have done these studies that, to no big surprise, mindfulness leads to a greater sense of well-being. But they've recently discovered that mindfulness plus compassion, now there's two things to do, moves you much more quickly into a sense of well-being. And just even more recently, they discovered that if you meditate on emptiness, the tantric nature of things, then it's even much more quickly than the other two stages. But we have to start where we are. Can we be mindful of where we're lost in grief? Can we have compassion for that place in ourselves? And can we then realize that it's all Maharaji, it's all the mother? There's this wonderful poem by Ram Prasad Sen, one of my favorite poets, and he was a great devotee of Kali. And he said, "Mother, in this lifetime, either you will devour me or I will devour you, and I make the vow that it is you that I will devour." And what he was meaning there is that we're devoured by life when we're overwhelmed by our feelings, when we're identified with there's this me perceiving an objective separate reality. But when we're devouring, when we're really present in loving awareness, then we're devouring the mother. And I just love that image of devouring the mother moment to moment, and then we get lost and she devours us for a while. Who's devouring whom?
That's a beautiful image. Thank you for that. It also sounds like you gave us the step-by-step process for us to not fall back into those habitual patterns of being closed down. So there's another question here from Ryan, who says, he mentions that Ram Dass tells Maharaji, "You can't send me back to America. I'm too impure." What do you think he meant by that? Or what do you think about that?
I lived with Ram Dass after we came back from India and in several places, in London and New Mexico and California. And I think all of us felt pretty impure. And I think it's easy to assume that being with Maharaji was this wonderful, amazing, great thing. And it was. But at the same time, it was really, really difficult, because we felt impure. We were bringing our neurosis to the feet of the guru. And how can I say this? The function of the guru is to show you that you are whole, that he loved me no matter how neurotic I was being. But yet my sanskaras, my conditioning was so strong, as was Ram Dass's, that even though we had been hours almost every day with Maharaji for months and months and months, that all those early childhood traumas or all what happened in high school or all those things that happened, that was still part of our conditioning. It wasn't that those things just disappeared because we were with Maharaji. And it was scary to think that, okay, now I'm going to go back to America where my parents live and where I have to make money and have to do all those things. Am I pure enough to really keep this connection with Maharaji? And yes, it didn't work out so easily for most of us. It was a real struggle to keep Maharaji in our hearts as we were going about a really busy life. And let me just tell you this one interesting story. I was in front of Maharaji at the temple in Kenshi, and I had the lucky spot that day where I was right up front, and I was able to be massaging his feet. And I felt so lucky. I'm massaging his feet, and I'm saying my mantra that he had given me, and just feeling overwhelming love. And then after 5 minutes of this, I started feeling proud that I had Maharaji's foot. And as soon as I started feeling proud, he started pulling his foot away. And I went right back to my mantra, and I got back to just love and God's name and Maharaji's foot, and it's all one. And that went on for a while. And then I got back to, oh, look at how lucky I am to be here right now. And as soon as there was an egocentric thought, he started pulling his foot away again. And I went back to doing the love thing. And it was just, even, it was so clear that even though I wasn't saying anything, he could feel the energy of me thinking an impure thought, whatever that is. And those impure thoughts followed me and Ram Dass and everybody really back to America. So that they say in India that the job of the guru takes place in that very first second where he shows you this is the possibility. There's this great book that that Parvati Marcus put together called Love Everybody, I believe. Is that the name, Love Everybody? And it's the stories of Westerners meeting Maharaji, and almost everybody in that book had the same line: when I met Maharaji, I felt like I was finally home for the first time in my life. But then we had to take that feeling of home and come back to physical home, which was not quite so easy. And it's still work. I mean, my sense about the pandemic is that we've been floating along on the surface of the water, like the water of life. And there's this big iceberg and we can see 10% of it. And then the pandemic knocks you out of your boat and you go under the water and you see there's another 90% of fear and grief and anxiety, all this stuff that was there all along, but you didn't really look at it hardly ever because you're so busy being active on the top of the surface there. So this is this incredible opportunity for awakening. My first meditation teacher, a lot of quotes are coming out of me today for some reason, Suzuki Roshi said, the most important thing is finding the most important thing. What is the most important thing for you? So that if the most important thing is getting free, then this pandemic is this fantastic opportunity. If the most important thing, on the other hand, is feeling safe or being happy or feeling connected to people, then the pandemic is like a nightmare, maybe, right? So that even before becoming mindful and the heart thing and then the tantric, even before that, there's the stage of cultivating motivation. And for most of us, we came to spiritual practice because we were suffering so much. There's some unusual people like Joseph Goldstein. He came to the Dharma because just he loved the Dharma. But for Ram Dass and me and almost everybody, you know, we came to the Dharma because we were suffering so much, we wanted some freedom from suffering. So,
yeah, that's how I think why many of us come. This is from Pamela. It said, after my mother died, I fell in love with someone who turned out to be a sociopath. It put me in a place of such separateness and so detached from love. How do you forgive abusive people? And also, how do we connect to love when the people we love the most are no longer with us?
Okay, a lot of good questions. So I was talking to somebody else just earlier today about keeping their heart open to Trump, but she's a student of mine and she's telling her friends that she feels compassion for Trump and they're all angry at her. They're, a lot of them are angry with her because they feel that he doesn't deserve her love. And compassion for somebody that's hurt you is not about approving of what they did or liking them or ever wanting to be around them again. Compassion and forgiveness is about yourself. It's about, can you keep your heart open even when the concept or the memory of this other person shows up? It's about healing you so that there's, like when I said before that Donald Trump will be at your bedside when you're dying, so will your sociopathic ex-boyfriend be at your bedside when you're dying. Any place that you're still holding on to, rejecting, pushing away, that's going to be part of your character structure. That's going to be what's let go of as you're going through the dying process. And if you're still grabbing onto that, that's going to limit the spiritual possibility of the dying process. So one could do a forgiveness practice or a compassion practice. There's a practice called Tonglen, T-O-N-G-L-E-N. There might be time to do a guided Tonglen practice at the end of the day here. I'm not sure. But if there's not, Pema Chodron talks about it. I have some guided Tonglen files on the Living Dying Project website. You go to the education link and there it is. Or you could just do forgiveness practice. And just suppose your boyfriend's name was Joe. Probably wasn't, but you can just start working with Joe, I forgive you. And even though you don't, yet, maybe. You can just imagine what that might feel like. Stephen Levine told me that he had such a hard time forgiving himself that he worked for years saying, "Stephen, I forgive you," just imagining what that might feel like. And one day it happened. One day he felt forgiven. And when he felt forgiven, he felt, "I felt so naked. I wanted to take all that guilt back again, but decided not to do it." Good for Stephen. Okay. So can you begin to open your heart to that? And as we were talking before about Tantra or the mother, it's all the mother. The sociopath is the mother. The pandemic is the mother. It's the dark mother. It's Kali. It's Durga. It's Shiva, destroying, devouring. And that eventually we have to open to the dark as well as to the light. The Tibetans say that when you're dying, the first thing that happens, or one of the first things that happens right after you die, is you encounter a light that's as bright as 1,000 suns. And that light is your true nature. And of course, the secret is that right now, you and I are living in that light. You and I are enlightened already, but we're so busy fixated on, "I'm here in California and you guys are scattered all over the planet," that it's hard to remember that we're this one consciousness, one being that's flowing through us. And we get lost in the separateness, which is also real, but forgetting the context of the spiritual oneness. So to the extent that we can keep going back to this sense of it's all the mother, it's all part of what can be open to. And of course, that's going to be a process. It's bringing together our psychological woundedness and our spiritual practice, and it goes back and forth. And it's certainly not a simple thing, and it's not an easy thing. It means being able to love your own woundedness, have compassion for the place where you were abandoned or neglected or hurt as you were growing up. At times when you were really vulnerable and unable to take care of yourself, you needed support. Can we have faith and trust that God is supporting us now, that everything is the path? There is nothing that's not the healing path. Nothing is a distraction from the path. The electronics is the path. The difficult boyfriend is the path.
So meaningful. So needed to hear that. So this one comes from Susanna. She's a hospice worker. And she says, "My mother died 3 years ago, and it transformed my life forever. I was sad, but it was so incredible because she was so intentional and conscious. How do I support others who have this? How do I support others who have this as a hospice worker?"
Who have this? I don't quite understand the language. That could be.
Yeah, I think what it's saying is to have this intention and consciousness in their dying process.
Okay. Well, I've been working with dying people, with Ram Dass and Stephen, since like 1978. So that's 88, 98, 08. It's almost like 40 years, over 40 years, believe it or not. Wow. Okay. So the dark and dirty secret is that there's no special qualities or talents or tricks needed to be with people who are dying. That exactly the same qualities that help you be present right now in this room, in your body, being grounded, being centered, being generous, being kind, being open-hearted, being forgiving, seeing that it's all true nature, are exactly the qualities that help you die well. Now, we've really only talked about the first few stages of the healing process. There's the mindfulness stage, embodied mindfulness. There's the heart stage, loving kindness, compassion, gratitude, forgiveness. There's the tantric stage, that we are that which we invoked in the beginning. The guru is none other than our own true nature. But then there's non-duality, what Eckhart Tolle talks about, what Ramana Maharshi talks about, what I talk about, what a lot of people talk about. And that's really crucial here, because what we die into is that non-duality. We die into oneness. And to the extent that we can practice that now as a meditation process, or being in nature, or being with music, or being with a child or an animal, going beyond the I who's doing it. So it in this healing unfoldment, development, initially, there is, I am being aware. I'm being aware of the content. I'm mindful of the content. And then we get to the heart stage. We're not so interested in the content as we are our relationship with the content. Do I have a loving relationship with the content? Do I have a compassionate relationship with the content? Can I forgive? Can I be present in a heartfelt way? And then we get to the tantric stage where we're not interested so much even in the relationship, but the nature of things itself. The nature is that it's all sacred. It's all the mother. It's all a devotional unfolding. It's all our embracing of our experience, no matter whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But then finally, when we're going into this with deep enough devotion and this tantric understanding, finally, it all becomes one. And that's what we die into. So that to the extent we've done some practice or some non-practice, like one of the slogans in non-dual Dzogchen practice is no meditation, no distraction. Nobody's meditating because there's nobody, and nothing is a distraction because it's all the beloved. No meditation, no distraction. To the extent we get there, then dying is just another moment of that. So that I do teach people how to be conscious caregivers, compassionate caregivers. But the deepest practice is not the tricks of doing Tonglen or doing the Ah breath or doing Powa or different practices that are talked about on the website. The deepest practice is how deeply can I be resting in wholeness when I'm around someone who's dying? Because when someone is dying, that's kind of a finger pointing at you that you're going to die too. That's going to uncover the fear of death in you. All fear is basically fear of death. As a recovering mathematician, I've got this equation. All fear equals fear of death, and fear of death equals lack of enlightenment. Any place where we're afraid, there's an I who's afraid of that out there other than I. And that's lack of enlightenment. There's nothing other than self, nothing. So that when we find fear, that can be good news. Suffering is grace, as Ram Dass said. Can we take our fear of death? Can we take our difficult emotions that are arising due to the pandemic, to social distancing and all the other uncertainty? And can that be grace? Because it's perfectly pointing at, here's what you do next. Here's what you need to do next to really awaken.
Nice. Thank you. This is from Isabel. She says, hi, thanks for this event. My question would be, how to not be overwhelmed by all that suffering that we see in humans and animals, and to accept that we can't prevent every being from suffering?
Okay. Well, that's a very deep question, Isabel, and there's all kinds of answers to it. One answer is that suffering is only suffering. Cancer doesn't cause suffering. Pandemic doesn't cause suffering. Divorce doesn't cause suffering. Resistance to cancer, resistance to pandemic, resistance to divorce. So if we go more deeply into that initial stage of mindfulness and actually begin to get how suffering is arising, that suffering is not the result of the environment, it's our relationship with it. You might start with unpleasant physical sensation and how we tend to, in a very automatic way, begin to resist unpleasant sensations. We're always scratching. There's the whole don't touch your face thing, which got cultivated some mindfulness maybe. But what I'm getting at here is when we really begin to get how suffering is arising, why it's from our resistance, it's our attachment, then suffering becomes grace. And as we can really get in a deep way how suffering is grace, the mind begins to stabilize. It's not trying to get away from suffering. And then the heart can begin to open. And the nature of the heart, as I mentioned before, one of the fundamental qualities of the heart is emptiness or spaciousness. There is room in the heart for all of the suffering in the universe. Every sentient being, every animal, every human being, all the people who are homeless, who are wondering how they're going to feed their children because of the pandemic or because of famine or because of war. There's room for all of that. And a very useful practice that I've been finding for people is to practice for everybody now. And if you can't do that, then can you practice for the part of you that's overwhelmed by the suffering of everybody? Okay, so you sit down and say, I'm going to do compassion practice for the suffering of all sentient beings. And you sit down and you feel overwhelmed by that. So then you say, okay, I'm going to do compassion practice for the part of me that's overwhelmed by all that suffering. I could do Tonglen for that, or I could just imagine suffering me in front of meditating me and begin to really feel compassion for how much that part of you has suffered because of this particular pattern.
Nice. You've mentioned the Tonglen practice a couple times, so I want people to know that we'll put that up on the Ram Dass Fellowship pages so that they can have access to that link.
Great.
Lee asks, this is sort of continuation, please speak more about compassion for my fear. Is this comfort for myself? I have a history of looking outside myself for comfort.
No, it's not distracting from your own. It's not. Okay, so the Dalai Lama says that one of the defining qualities of compassion is the ability to equalize and switch yourself with another person. Okay, so it's a little more obvious when we're talking about somebody out there. You see somebody who's suffering, and can you feel equal to them? It's not compassion for somebody. It's compassion with. It's being with the other person suffering. Can you be with the suffering of all suffering on the planet? And if you're overwhelmed by that, then what can you have compassion for? So, could you read the question again? I apologize.
Yes, hang on. I'm going to scroll back up to it. Please speak about compassion for my fear.
Okay.
Is this comfort for myself? I have a history of looking outside myself for comfort.
Okay. So that in Buddhism, there's a near and far enemy for wholesome qualities. So the far enemy of compassion is feeling indifferent. I don't care that you're suffering. That's your problem. But the near enemy of compassion is pity. And we can feel sorry for ourselves to the extent that you're pulling away from your own fear, you're pushing it away, you're trying to avoid it, that's creating more suffering. What does it feel like when you're pushing away fear? If you really pay attention to what's going on in your body, in your belly, in your heart, in your shoulders, there's suffering there. If you can actually be with in clear awareness and then open your heart to that, then the suffering begins to dissipate in the vast spaciousness that is the heart. So that these open-hearted qualities of being connected to and being spacious around, I find very, very useful metaphorically as a way of dealing with difficult emotions, particularly fear. Fear is the most difficult of all emotions. It's the one right down there at the very basis of the unconscious. So if we can be with, can you be with the fear? Not with the trigger, not with what I'm afraid of. It's not I'm afraid of that stuff out there, the people out there, that situation out there. No, it's being with what does it feel like in my body to be afraid? And can I begin to bear those feelings? And to the extent you can, and then that you can be open-hearted to those sensations, they will begin to dissipate because the heart is boundlessly spacious. We're concerned that this pain is so deep that it's going to overwhelm me. And at times it will. At times it will become overwhelming. And then you have compassion for feeling overwhelmed. So it's a very simple but very difficult process of, am I motivated enough to do this work? And the beginning of the work is to be with what is going on here, be embodied, having embodied mindfulness, letting go of all the stories and the narratives, just being with it the way it is, and then opening my heart to that, loving it, or if there's suffering, can I have compassion for that? Stephen Levine defined compassion as the ability to keep your heart open in hell. For many of us, that's a lifetime's job. And the fact that you're even asking the question is really very great news.
Yeah, thank you. Zach asks, as far as your own practice today, do you find that those old neuroses have dissolved through practice over time? Or have you learned to make friends with them and not get caught in them as much?
It's some of both. Ram Dass had this great line. I don't know how true it is. But he said, if you're a son of a bitch and you get enlightened, you'll be an enlightened son of a bitch. And yet I think if you're too much of a son of a bitch, it's hard to get enlightened because you're not opening your heart and things like that. So my personality over the years, I've been meditating since the 1960s, has gotten less quirky, but I'm still this neurotic guy. I just don't care about it anymore. That's not who I am. That's the package, if you will. Who I am is pure consciousness. Who I am is a manifestation of Maharaji's love. And yes, at times I identify with the separateness, and I go to body workers, and I haven't been in therapy for a long time, but I try to pay attention to my, you know, how is neurosis getting in the way of being effective in the world? But even when it's getting in the way of being effective, to keep remembering that that's not who I am. It's all the beloved. I can just relax into that. I can go beyond trying. Can practice become resting in rather than trying to do something? Am I approaching practice from this neurotic standpoint of a sense of impoverishment and inadequacy, that I'm trying to get somewhere, or am I going into practice from a sense of wholeness and romance and fullness, that really all I need to do is be with what's going on because it's all God unfolding.
Oh, hallelujah. You just let us all off the hook about being perfect in all of this. That perfectionist mind can come in so many ways. So that's so fabulous. There's a question here that says, Ram Dass said he is a soul. Is there still a Ram Dass soul, or has he dissolved into non-duality with no trace of his individual soul?
You mean now that he's died, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not that interested in what happens after you die, whether it's heaven and hell or reincarnation or Shirley MacLaine or whatever it is. What I'm interested in is, what do we need to know and do to be more awake and alive this next moment? How alive am I? How alive are you willing to be? And the more we go into that, then the more we die fully. And then the soul that survives death, if such a thing happens, is more fully surrendered into, I don't know, language is failing me a bit right now. So I guess what I would say is that the closest I can come to having a picture of how this all works is that I'm a candle and you're a candle. Everybody's a candle, and everybody's candle has an individual flame, that my flame is not the same as your flame. And just as I'm about to die, just as I'm dying, God takes another candle and lights it from my candle. My candle goes out, and then there's this new candle. And so the flame of the new candle is completely determined by the quality of the old candle. So that, is there a soul? When Ram Dass kept saying, I'm a soul, I was uncomfortable with that term is maybe too strong. But to me, it's more like we're all true nature. We're all Maharaji. We're all God. Whether you call it a soul or true nature. And I have a very, very deep faith that does survive death. But it's not necessarily that Ram Dass' soul is hanging out in some other plane of existence and is like showering grace on everybody, that it's on to the next thing in some way, that the world's religions argue about how that happens. And I don't really want to get into that argument.
Very Buddhist of you.
Yeah. I tried to get out of the answer there as best I could. So.
Brittany asks, what type of meditation or mantra can I do to help with dealing with my past trauma related to death?
Okay, well, it's hard to generalize without knowing you and knowing what your character structure is, but just in general, first of all, if being grounded, doing a grounding meditation, is a very direct antidote to fear. And then doing some heart kind of meditation to forgive yourself for being caught in this, to do Tonglen for yourself. One of the most powerful healing practices I know is to identify the place with the deepest honesty you can find. Here's the place that I am most caught. And then imagine that part of you in front of you, and you can see the suffering on that face of that part of you. And then you go into meditation and you begin to do Tonglen, taking the suffering with compassion and sending the antidote with loving kindness, focusing on how much compassion can I have for how you suffered? How much loving kindness can I give to you? And in doing this, generally we do the opposite thing. Generally, we take in the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff. Here we're taking in the bad stuff and sending out the good stuff. We're actually cutting at the root, the place of self-clinging, self-cherishing. It's a very liberating practice to be willing to take in the suffering of part of yourself or somebody else or even a whole group of people. I mean, could we sit here at the end of the day today and spend 5 minutes breathing in the suffering of all the people who are frightened because of COVID and sending out the antidote, a feeling of strength or confidence or courage with loving kindness, breathing in with compassion, breathing out with loving kindness, the antidote. And just in doing that, just in even beginning to pretend, fake it till you make it, that you can open to all that suffering rather than be overwhelmed by it is a very healing process.
There's actually a request for that. So let's take the last 5 minutes and do that practice if you're open to it.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, so we'll take a couple more questions and then move into that.
Okay. It might take more like 7 or 8 minutes, but let's take one more question.
Okay, that's going to be hard.
Okay, two questions.
For okay, me. Great. So this is from Dan. It says, do we practice forgiveness or do we allow it?
Trick question. Okay, Dan. Well, if you can just allow it, that's great. But for a lot of people, a lot of the time, it takes practice. It's not a natural thing. There's a lot of conditioning behind not forgiving people. And so I'm a guy, and a lot of the way that I do my teaching, I've noticed in the past years, has come out of a male-oriented, here's a way to do things and fix things. But the longer I practice, I really get that practice is more about receiving grace, allowing, surrendering, and getting beyond doing. But to the extent that you think you have to do, then you probably got to do some doing. And then you do enough that you get to the point, well, I don't have to do this so much anymore. I can allow it to happen because grace is there. And keep your eyes out for that awakening of grace. Keep your eyes out for, I can begin to relax and I don't have to try so hard. What is the effort that needs to be made? Is there something that really needs to be done other than putting your butt on the cushion and receiving grace? I mean, here's another one of my dirty secrets, that I really believe that the main point of practice is to realize that it doesn't work and that you have to give up and surrender and that it's all God's grace. But you can't know that until you've tried your hardest. If you've tried only a little bit, you're always thinking, if I would have tried harder, then I could have gotten there. But it really is an act of grace. The awakening is an act of grace. One more question.
All right, this is hard. This is, how can I feel supported by the mother when someone has trespassed on me or an old trauma is triggered?
Okay, that's a really great question. And a couple of answers. One is, you've got to go back to the beginning. What is your motivation? What do you really want in life? And if you want to be free in life, then you'll gradually get that even that trespassing was grace, that was showing you something, it was making you stronger. But at the same time, it sure didn't feel like it when it was happening. It might not even feel like grace now. It might feel dirty. It might feel awful. And When I first started teaching this stuff with Stephen Levine, we were talking about forgiveness. There were a lot of younger women coming who had been sexually abused and could not forgive their perpetrators. And even though they knew intellectually that that's what needed to happen, and Stephen came up with this notion, can you at least do this visualization or this practice of, I wish that you no longer be motivated by hatred, that you think of the person who abused you and you just hope that they're no longer motivated by hatred. And if there has been such a deep wound that you can't just surrender into forgiveness and compassion, that it really comes back then to having compassion for that part of yourself that can't have compassion for the other person. And again, people have come to me and said, there is somebody that I cannot forgive. That person abused me. That person allowed me to be abused. That person really hurt me. And I try to forgive them because I know that hatred is not a way to heal things, but I can't get beyond how deeply I'm hurt. And the instruction then is, can you have compassion for that place in yourself? And that eventually then there's enough healing at that level that you can begin to extend it. I mean, in some ways, love and compassion are always for self, but as practice deepens, what we think of as self begins to expand. Originally, self is me. I need to not suffer so much. But as we work with that smaller self, it becomes clear that self is everybody all the time.
That's great. Thank you. So I want to, before we go into the meditation, I would like to just do a couple of the announcements because I don't want to do them after when we're in that space. So I'll just let you all know that I'll be posting the Tonglen practice and other things on the Ram Dass Fellowship Facebook group pages. Also, this video will be up on the link and the webpage until May 4th, and it's free and available for you to watch. You can also make donations, which is always very helpful. And there's also going to be several more opportunities for fellowship and for connection in the coming weeks and months. We have a book reading and book club coming up. And so make sure you watch out for those. And if you're not already, sign up for the fellowship page by going to ramdass.org and searching fellowship. And then Ramdev, you have a website as well, the livingdyingproject.org. Is that right?
No.
What is it then? Sorry about that.
Livingdying.org.
.org. Okay. Wonderful. So thank you all so much for being a part. It's such a lovely treat to get to be with you all. So now we get to move into our meditation. Thank you so much for being here.
So do I really have to get done by 6:15, which is only 3+ minutes here?
I say take as long as you need to for the meditation.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if people need to leave, fine. But I think if we're really going to do this, we should take somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes. Although I do want to say very clearly that I'm a great fan of a lot of super short sessions during the day. Instead of I should meditate an hour at a time, meditate 30 times at 2 minutes each. And just really settle into the body, just like you're going to your car, you're going from room to room, you're lying down to bed, you're chopping your vegetables. And can you become mindful? Can you open your heart? Can you feel that the vegetables are the mother, that the whole thing is God? Okay, so find a comfortable sitting position. Bring your attention into your body. And begin by looking at your motivation. What is it that you want? What is the most important thing? Why did you come to this meeting today? What is your heart's desire? What would you like to have happen? The most important thing before you die. What does it even mean to you that you're going to die, but you don't know when? can that motivate a deeper surrender into these few moments together of practice? And with this motivation, then please invoke that which you trust, the Christ, the Mother, the Buddha, your own true nature, the higher power. Please invoke that which allows you to trust that that which is arising in body and mind doesn't have to be fixed or improved, that you can more directly begin to meet that which is arising with a great sense of openness and trust, relaxation, yet clarity. And letting this trust also be brought into your physical body by first taking a few grounding breaths. As you breathe out, imagine you can push down through the base of your torso into the earth that supports and nourishes, pushing down energy, receiving grounding, supportive, nourishing energy from earth element, from the mother. Easy, natural in-breath with each out-breath, pushing down into the earth, feeling your legs and your feet. And if there is resistance to being so far away from the mind that wants to be in charge, just notice that without letting it be a problem. And with this next out-breath, dropping down through the base, inhabiting the root chakra. If you have a hard time feeling this, you can tighten the muscles in the perineum and the upper inner thigh adductor muscles. But it's not a muscular exercise. It's inhabiting a part of your energetic body that many of us have partly abandoned. The antidote to fear, trusting the sense of support. What does it feel like to be a bit more grounded? The mind settling, the body opening and relaxing. And then in a very similar way, dropping down into the lower belly, the hara becoming centered a few inches down below the navel, a few inches inside the front of the body. Letting your identity drop down into your energetic and physical center of gravity, dropping down into the belly. Almost as if you could pay attention from the belly, instead of paying attention to the belly, letting your identity drop down. Dropping down into the belly with each out-breath, almost as if you were dying from the mind into the center. The feeling of centeredness allows you to hear my voice, to feel other parts of your body. Thoughts, images, emotions may arise, but you're centered. You're stable. You're not thrown off by activity. So very briefly now, we've explored being grounded and being centered. I would encourage you to spend a lot more time with these if it might seem productive. For many people, becoming embodied deeply stabilizes meditation practice. But they are the foundation then, this embodied mindfulness, to begin to open the heart. As if you could breathe into the center of your chest, as if there were nostrils in the center of your chest. Breathing in love, breathing in compassion, breathing out boundless spaciousness in all directions, to the front and the back, to the right, to the left, above and below. Breathing in love, compassion, breathing out spaciousness, the foundation of being grounded and centered allows you to bear the deep vulnerability and emptiness of the truly open heart. Breathing out into boundlessness with each exhalation. And then ask yourself, is there a part of you that's been suffering lately that is available to be worked with? Might not be what the mind would expect, but asking from your heart, is there something that is ready to be brought into this healing process? Maybe it's a very deep woundedness, possibly it's something that's not quite so deep. Either way, can you imagine that that part of you that's been suffering is seated a few feet in front of you? You can see how this part of you has been feeling by the expression on her or his face. And the first part of this Tonglen process is, can you begin to feel how this part of you has been suffering? Not just imagine it, but feel what you're imagining, feel what you're remembering. The meditating you is beginning to feel in this grounded, centered, open-hearted way, the suffering of the suffering part of you. Feel it in your body, feel it in your mind, feel it as nakedly and directly as you're willing. Feel it more and more deeply until you become willing to have compassion. Compassion begins to naturally arise because you feel that suffering so acutely, and your nature is compassion. You begin to feel compassion, a deep wish, an open-hearted wish that the suffering you be free of suffering. And as you're breathing in and out with each breath, you're going more deeply into this feeling of compassion. A deep wish that she, a deep wish that he be free from suffering, be happy, be free. And compassion deepens and deepens until it gets to the point now where meditating you is becoming willing to take the suffering into you. And as you breathe in, you imagine that the suffering of suffering you is congealing. And with deep compassion, you take it in through every pore of your body into your heart of hearts. And as you breathe out, you send the antidote with loving kindness. You might want to use a visualization. I'm more of a feeling person than a visualizer. The main focus is on feeling compassion as you're taking on the in-breath, and loving kindness as you're sending the antidote on the out-breath. But you could visualize the suffering congealing as hot, dark smoke, and the antidote is cool, white light. Taking suffering with compassion on the in-breath, sending the antidote with loving kindness on the out-breath. You might notice that we're not fixing the bad stuff and converting it into the good stuff. Your heart is boundless. We're just taking it, realizing the boundless, spacious, empty nature of heart, and sending the antidote with boundless love. A deep wish that this part of you be free from suffering. Deep love for the part of you that has suffered. And in doing this, you're cutting at the root, that place of you that's trying to avoid suffering, that needs to protect. And then imagine that this suffering you is joined by countless beings who are suffering in roughly approximately the same way that you are. The same emotional situation, the same physical situation, whatever it might be, that part of suffering you is now joined by countless other beings. And once again, taking the practice now from the personal to the impersonal to the collective, working more with the quality of suffering than this part of you, begin to feel how all these beings are suffering collectively. You know it so well because it is so similar to your own. All these people want to be happy just like you and everyone else wants to be happy. Feel their collective suffering. Feel it more and more acutely. Feel it more and more openly. Beyond imagining, really feeling it. So deeply that you begin to feel compassion for all of these beings. A deep wish that each of them be free from suffering, that each of them be whole. Taking the collective suffering with compassion on in-breath, sending the antidote on the out-breath, compassion for all these countless beings. Then finally wishing them and this suffering part of yourself a fond farewell, a loving farewell. They all dissolve into spaciousness. You're back, meditating you, motivated, grounded, centered, supporting the open heart, the boundless heart. Receiving grace through the heart with each breath. Sending out boundless compassion in infinite directions with each exhalation. Many people feel the most important part of meditation is right after the bell. How much can you, I, integrate into our daily life the sense of openness, the sense of trust, this willingness to surrender? Is it necessary that becoming active, getting involved in electronics or moving about, need distract us from that which is most important? What does it feel like right now? What is the most important thing? May all beings be free from fear. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be free. Thank you also very much. It's been a real privilege to be with you. If you get in any deep or confused place through these teachings, feel free to send me an email, which is plastered on every page of the website, livingdying.org. And thank you, Jackie, for being such a great host and for JR and Mangalam for doing the technical end. The Love Server Member Foundation is really carrying on these profoundly wonderful teachings of Ram Dass and of Maharaji. The Dharma is such a gift that it's almost hard to imagine approaching the pandemic without teachings, without the ability to practice, without having the tools to work with fear and anxiety and despair. So it is my great gift that I had the opportunity to be with so many wonderful beings and have these teachings and being able to share them. And I honor each of you in your practice and wish you all the very best. Thank you. Thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.